Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
My mind is like an internet browser. At least 19 tabs open, 3 of them are frozen, and I have no damn clue where the music is coming from. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I am the captain of this hot mess of a ship, and I want to just give a really quick rundown on what the hell is an adult child. Now, when someone is trying to figure out whether or not they're an adult child, I say, don't try to figure out if your family was dysfunctional. Let's first see if you can relate to the common characteristics of an adult child. Now, this is how I realized that I was an adult child, was after reading The Laundry List, which are the 14 common characteristics of an adult child of an alcoholic and dysfunctional family, which I'm going to read to you in just one second. Now, I had known that I had grown up in an alcoholic and dysfunctional family. However, I was unaware of the pervasive impact that had and was having on my life as an adult. And I think that this is the case for a lot of people. A lot of people don't even realize that they grew up in a dysfunctional family. And even more people don't realize how much their childhood experiences are impacting their day-to-day life. So let's look at this damn laundry list, okay, and see if you can relate. Now, I want to say you don't have to relate to every single one to be an adult child, but I would say that if you can resonate with maybe 3 or more, you're probably in the right place, folks, okay? So here we go. 1, we became isolated and afraid of people and authority figures. 2, we became approval seekers and lost our identity in the process. 3, we were frightened by angry people and any personal criticism. 4, we either become alcoholics, marry them, or both, or find another compulsive personality, such as a workaholic, to fulfill our sick abandonment needs. Ugh. 5, we live life from the viewpoint of victims, and we are attracted by that weakness in our love and friendship relationships. 6, we have an overdeveloped sense of responsibility, and it is easier for us to be concerned with others rather than ourselves. 7, we get guilt feelings when we stand up for ourselves instead of giving in to others. 8, we became addicted to excitement. 9, we confuse love and pity and tend to love people we can pity and rescue. 10, we have stuffed our feelings from our traumatic childhoods and have lost the ability to feel or express our feelings because it hurts so much. 11, we judge ourselves harshly and have a very low sense of self-esteem. 12, and this is the one that when I read this, I shit my pants. So just be prepared in case you do too, okay? 12, we are dependent personalities who are terrified of abandonment and will do anything to hold on to a relationship in order not to experience painful abandonment feelings, which we receive from living with sick people who are never there emotionally for us. 13, alcoholism is a family disease, and we became para-alcoholics and took on the characteristics of that disease, even though we did not pick up the drink. 14, para-alcoholics are reactors rather than actors. If 13 and 14 didn't make any sense to you, don't worry. Don't worry about it. You'll hear me probably explain those in another episode. So, as I said, 3 or more, you're probably in the right place, folks. You're probably in the right place, folks. But guess what? Realizing that I was an adult child was such a damn blessing, because for so long, I couldn't figure out what the hell was going on with me. I couldn't figure out why I kept finding myself in one toxic relationship after the next, in spite of, you know, promising myself that I was going to do things differently, that I wasn't going to ignore red flags, that I wasn't going to lose myself as soon as I got into a relationship. And I had been completely incapable of doing so. And it wasn't until I realized that I was an adult child and started to address these issues that I was really able to start healing and change. So if you're just realizing that you're an adult child and you're kind of freaking out, don't. There are a million bajillion of us out there. There is a path to healing and recovery, and we are actually quite fun and quite funny, and we have a lot of fun here especially. I am an acquired taste, just so you know. We like to curse here, just so you know. And yeah, welcome aboard. So today we are diving deep with returning guest, friend of the pod, Kristen Carter. She is the host of the I Have ADHD podcast. Now, when Kristen was on the first time, it was a little over a year ago, and I had just been diagnosed with ADHD. Now, I'm going to be honest, folks. I am starting to wonder, starting to think that I really don't know if I have ADHD. I really think that the ADHD symptoms that I experience, I really do think it's related to phone addiction and just changes that have occurred to my brain. But we will dive into that in another episode in the future. That being said, there is a ton of overlap in the symptoms of complex PTSD and ADHD. I think that a lot of people have both. I think anybody listening to this podcast right now, like if you're wondering whether it's ADHD or complex PTSD, it's definitely complex PTSD. And there's also a strong possibility that it's also ADHD. But if you're listening to this podcast, the possibility of it just being ADHD and not complex PTSD, I'm sorry, it's not realistic. It's not realistic. So I'll put a link to Kristen's first episode or first appearance on the pod where we probably dive into this more as far as like the overlapping symptoms. So what's really interesting is when Kristen came on, and you'll hear me talk about this in the beginning, she was just kind of coming to terms with the fact that she is an adult child, that she grew up in a dysfunctional family. And as I have the reputation to do so, I have a way in which I get people to get vulnerable, get raw, and open up. And so her appearance a year ago was, I think it was probably the first time that she really opened up about what was going on with her as far as like coming to terms with the fact that she grew up in a toxic family. And so it's really interesting. You'll get to hear all of the insights and growth and ahas that she's had since we last spoke. And then we're just talking about a whole bunch of different topics related to ADHD, complex PTSD. We're talking about self-trust, cultivating self-trust. We're talking about parenting. We're talking about emotional regulation. We're talking about a whole bunch of just good topics. So let's get the damn show on the road. But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to damn the Join Chit Show. This is my online support community where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups where you can connect with other shit shows who are committed to doing the damn work to heal and want to have a little fun doing so. You will not find a more authentic and vulnerable and raw and compassionate and loving community out there. It is really such a fucking special place, folks. We had a meeting, I guess it was on Sunday. Somebody was sharing. I was like, geez Louise, this is such a special place. So you're missing out. You're missing out. So how about you damn the Join Shit Show? See the link in the show notes for a way to join. Next, give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at Adult Child Pod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. That shit really helps in reaching more listeners. You guys, there are a ton of adult children out there who don't know that they're an adult child who desperately need to find this podcast. And you leaving me a 5-star review, and if you could actually write a review, Thank you. Love you all. Well, she's back, folks. Kristen Carter, host of I Have ADHD. Welcome. Welcome aboard.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about how you felt when you came on the last time. How did I even get you to like open up? I don't even remember. Like, did we talk about this before? Did I just really get you to go? And I just used my special powers of getting people to open up.
You really did. And I innocently was like, I'm coming on the podcast to talk about ADHD. And then all of a sudden I'm bearing my soul in ways that I think I was pretty self-protective. Mm-hmm. And I did hold back in a good way. You know, I wasn't quite ready to be sharing things. But I got off of that interview thinking, oh my word, what just happened? What just happened? So I'm very glad to be back a year later, maybe over a year later, just really
a little over a year. So, okay. So let's backtrack. Like right when we recorded, like this was all like very fresh as far as like seeing your family for what it was. Like how fresh was this? Can we like take us back in time as to like where you were then?
So the process for me was several years long, but about 2 weeks prior to recording this episode was when I had finally made the decision. I can't do this anymore. Nothing is changing. Nothing is changing or will ever change.
With your parents, just so people are clear.
Yes, with my parents specifically. And it had gotten to the point where I was enacting boundaries and setting boundaries, and I had already gone like no contact for a little while. And you know the drill. It's everybody's. I feel like when I hear people's story, I'm like, oh yeah, that's exactly how it goes. So if you know, you know. But it had gotten to the point where they were like reaching out to my kids in ways that I didn't like, and that to me was like, okay, this is where we're drawing the line. And so, yeah, it was about 2 weeks prior that I had just like finally sent that no contact letter and really had made like the final decision of like, we're done here, which is so, so devastating.
Yeah. It's like, because it represents so much more. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's such a long time coming.
Yes.
And you work so freaking hard to try to avoid it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I tried to contort myself in so many different ways. And I spent thousands of dollars on therapy with multiple therapists trying to get someone to tell me that I was the problem. Mm-hmm. Please tell me that I am the problem so that, 'cause I know how to fix me. I know how to change me. I know how to contort myself. I know how to change. So could somebody just tell me that I'm the problem? And I saw four different therapists trying to get someone to tell me that I was the problem.
Well, let's unpack that. 'Cause like, what did that look like? And like, when was the realization that that's what you were doing? And I'm curious, like, at what point did you, like end a relationship like with one therapist and be like, nope, they're not giving me what I want. And then like move on to like, what did that look like?
So it looks like I have a long-term relationship with my original first therapist. I was so lucky. In 2018, I went to a therapist. Her name is Sharon. God bless Sharon.
Hi, Sharon.
Went to her for the first time and she told me that I was traumatized and I got offended and left and was like, get out of here. What are you talking about? I don't have any trauma. And 2 years, 3 years later, I went back and was like, Sharon,
you're right.
So I still have a relationship with her and I'm still in therapy with her, but I hired people more on like a consultation basis outside of my relationship with Sharon, because at some point, and I don't know, like for anyone who's been through this with toxic family systems or narcissistic family systems, where you're just uncovering how toxic it really is, I then turned on my therapist. So I turned on Sharon. I was like, You're the narcissist. You're the problem here. You're the one you're just trying to get me not to like my parents. And she was like, totally fair. I totally hear you. I totally understand. And so with her blessing,
said that to her.
Yeah. She was like, I totally understand what you're saying. She said, sometimes I think about that. Like, I wonder if you think that maybe I'm like trying to turn you against your parents. And that was so validating to hear. First of all, she thinks about me.
Absolutely. Right? That's like, yeah, we always want to be the favorite, right?
I mean, if anybody goes to therapy, you're just like, oh my gosh, you think about me?
That's my number one priority. It's like, oh, not to like be told I'm the problem, not to get well, but just to be the favorite. Let's be honest.
Yes. To make her laugh and for her to think that I'm funny. And for her to think about me outside of the therapeutic office space, I am winning. Mm-hmm. So she just validated it and was like, absolutely, I totally understand. And so I sought out three different therapists. They were all therapists. One was like acting as a coach, but she had been trained as a therapist. And all of them specialized in children of narcissistic parents. And I just went to them and was like, this isn't really it, right? And all of them, were like, honey, you're not the problem. And I was like, I hate you. I'm so mad at you. It takes a while to make that shift, because when you are groomed and brought up to believe that your parents are God's gift to mankind, it takes a long time to unravel that. What is his name? He wrote Healing the Shame That Binds You. John Bradshaw.
John Bradshaw.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He calls it the fantasy bond. And I will tell you, I was fantasy bonded AF. Like, I was the most fantasy bonded person. So essentially, when there is toxicity and abuse in a parent-child relationship, the child will bond to the parent through a fantasy of their own. So not because of a true connection, but because of a fantasy. And I had to keep that fantasy alive in order to stay connected. And I wanted to stay connected. Yes, absolutely. It meant the most to me for 4 decades. For 4 decades, I was fantasy bonded. And cutting that bond and the toxic hope and all of that, you know, that took 3 years.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because it's smashing that is there is the illusion of control, right? As far as like thinking that we're the problem. But actually it's like the opposite, right? Like, we don't really have any control. If we're like letting go of that is what allows us to not really control the situation, but
take matters into our own hands,
be active participants.
And, exactly.
Yes, and yeah. And along for
it, it is such a, counterintuitive thing, because you think like, if I can be fantasy bonded, which of course is unconscious, and if I can control me, and if I can just change me and tweak me, and if I can try hard enough, then I can make them love me, or then I can make them accept me, or then I can make this relationship healthy enough for me to remain in. But it's actually letting go of that and sacrificing that at the altar of the fantasy bond, really, where you're able to then be autonomous, to then make decisions for yourself, to then truly protect yourself, to then put yourself in a scenario where you're healthy and safe.
What do you think about as far as beliefs that you held about yourself that you had to let go of or consider weren't necessarily true as a result of doing so? And it's really interesting how, like, I mean, these can be negative and faulty beliefs, right? But like, there is a sense of safety and comfort and familiarity in some of these beliefs that we held. So I'm wondering, like, not only is it a matter of coming to terms with who your parents actually are, but I'm curious about what that was like as far as coming to terms with who you are.
The first ones that come to mind are centered around the belief of being too dramatic, being too sensitive, being too much. This idea that my perception of reality is not correct. I was gaslit so severely that I really struggled to understand reality. And I would always need outside validation of like, am I being weird here? Am I the problem here? What's going on here? And it's only in the last couple months, actually, that I really feel this groundedness in like, excuse me, no, I know what reality is. I know that I am not being too much here. But that takes a long time, because when you are so convinced that you are dramatic, that you are too much, that you're too emotional and too sensitive, then you see, of course, it's so convenient for the toxic family system, because then everything that happens, you get to say, well, I know I'm being too dramatic, or I know that this is my stuff. That was a big thing. Like, you got to take responsibility for your stuff, which is just, the irony of it is out of this world. The responsibility to handle my own emotions when being abused, neglected, and mistreated was just like, well, this is my stuff, so I need to handle it. And then learning, no. There's accountability to be had in relationships, and you deserve to be treated with kindness and respect and mutuality and reciprocity. And you should have the ability to be autonomous and make your own decisions without scrutiny and punishment. That was all new concepts. And, you know, I'm saying this as someone who is in a very relatively healthy marriage. So
yeah, how the hell did that happen?
I think it was just divine intervention. Honestly, now when we got married, he's changed a lot in 20 years. We've been married for 20 years, and he's changed a lot. I've changed a lot. We've both evolved. So I would say when we were dating and newly married, he was as emotionally unavailable as I needed him to be in order to connect with him. Mm-hmm. Right? Because if he was emotionally available, there is no way that I would have been able to connect with him in that state. And I was young. I was a baby. We were married when I was 23. So we started dating when I was 21. So he was as emotionally unavailable as I needed him to be, and has grown into being an emotionally available, safe, yada, yada, yada. Great. Good for me. Whatever. But having the contrast of how I felt in my marriage versus how I felt in my family system was important, because it really did show me the difference between the two, how my body felt at home with my husband and my kids versus how I felt in my parents' home. There was a stark contrast, and that eventually became really important information for me.
Was there any connection between, because at what point, when did you start your podcast?
Very end of 2018.
When did you get your ADHD diagnosis?
I was 21. Okay, it was in the early 2000s.
When was it that you started to learn about the connection with trauma and ADHD? When was that?
That's such a great question. So I would say around 2019, things started to come up about trauma and ADHD. And I always identified as someone who had never experienced trauma.
Yep.
So when the conversations would come up, I would be very dismissive of it, because like, well, that's great, but I've never experienced trauma, so it doesn't apply to me. Ironically, now transitioning to someone who identifies as highly traumatized, having learned that trauma is not like one big event, but lots of little things that can happen over time, and no soft place to land. And for me, there was no soft place to land. Neither parent was safe. And I was very isolated from family. My parents were missionaries in the island of Guam. I was homeschooled. The amount of isolation is staggering. And so now being able to look back and see that trauma was a huge impact on my life, that didn't really happen until I was sitting face to face with my therapist. And she just started, I would tell a story and she would say, well, that's trauma. And I would be like, what? No, that's not a big deal. And then I would tell another story and she would say, well, that's trauma. And it was just over and over and over of having my story heard and validated, and also the look of horror on her face as I shared it, right? So you share a story and it's just your life. It's just your, this is just normal. This is just how I grew up. This was just not a big deal. And then to have a mirror, have someone looking back at you who is horrified, that changes you. That changes a person. And so I had to first engage with my own trauma before I could acknowledge that, like, across the board, trauma really is, especially systemic trauma, as far as like being neurodivergent in a neurotypical world. So I go to school and I'm neurodivergent in a system that is built for neurotypical people. So even if you come from a wonderful family, you're still experiencing that systemic trauma of, you know, having a brain that's not built for the systems that you're operating in.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting. And I know that you're still, you know, unpacking all of this, and it's not something that you've dug into super heavily on your own podcast, which makes sense because I still think it's so fresh. But I personally think that, like, this is like a large part of like what you're, I don't know. I just think that you're supposed to be reaching an audience as it relates to this stuff. I just think the way that it unfolded for you, I just see this as being like, you know, part of an important message that you're supposed to spread.
I really appreciate that. I will say, within the safety of my own program, I use air quotes because, like, there are hundreds of people in that program, but still, it's a very safe environment where I attract my people. And it feels really safe. And so within that environment, I speak freely, and I do feel a very strong calling to talk open and honestly about how our families can impact our lives, how our families can impact our nervous systems, how hypervigilance is not just an ADHD thing. It can also be a trauma thing, and all, like, that conversation. I'm much more willing to have right now in the privacy of my own, privacy is hysterical to say, because there's a lot of people there, but in the privacy of my own program, but I'm getting there on my podcast. I just think
I think you're still making sense of everything, but I just think the way it unfolded for you, it's not by mistake.
Yeah. I want to make sure that I'm speaking from the scar and not the wound, and make sure that, you know, as I'm talking to my own people, that it's not coming from a place of woundedness or a need to, like, I don't know. And maybe that's some of the, like, you're dramatic, you're too sensitive, you're all of that. I don't know. But right now I'm pretty protective. But hey, I'll share my guts here. Obviously.
Okay, shit show dudes, you can tune out. This is for my fellow shit show ladies. Are you going through perimenopause or menopause? I'm not quite there yet, but I know that I have plenty to look forward to. Feeling like a wet sock driving down the highway. Night sweats. Poor sleep. Feeling tired all the time. Bloating. Gas. Man, can't wait for this shit. Now, if that is applicable to you, then you have to try Hormone Harmony. So Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 fucking seconds, okay? Now, Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work. Now, for my younger shit show women like myself, if you struggle from that vicious week before your period, you want to crawl out of your skin, experience cravings, want to eat everything in the damn house, you feel a little bit down or off, well, Happy Mammoth also has a product for you to make it easier to manage your PMS with their Estro Control. So for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code adultchild at checkout. That's happymammoth.com, and use the code adultchild for 15% off today.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
How is it, through coming to terms with this, how has it changed your relationship with your ADHD? And are there any things that, like, you think are like what you view to be as like symptoms of your ADHD or related to your ADHD that you've now been able to, I don't know, come at from a different angle or like tackle in a way that you haven't before? Like, I'm just curious how this is the impact to your, like, quote unquote, relationship or recovery with ADHD. I don't know if I want to say recovery.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I'm so glad you asked, because I think that as we are understanding ADHD, and depending on when you got a diagnosis and where you are in your journey, there's this level of acceptance that really needs to be embraced. Mm. And for me, there was level number one, which was like, accept the diagnosis, accept what this means about me. All of these traits that I just thought were character flaws, all of the things that I hated about myself, oh, they're actually connected to ADHD. So it's a huge relief. And then how do I set my life up to be able to handle this? So how am I going to treat it? How am I going to accommodate myself? But then there's this inner critic. Once we've kind of triaged all of that, there is this really bitchy inner critic that I think most ADHDers have, but especially those of us who are highly traumatized. And there's research, obviously, you've read all of the things on this, but I'm rereading Pete Walker's book right now. And it just talks so much about the inner critic and it being a result of complex trauma. And I will raise my hand and say, that is a huge part of my ADHD that I now attribute to trauma rather than to ADHD. Because if I lived in an environment that helped me to view my symptoms as normal for someone with ADHD, as not a problem, hey, this is just something that you're dealing with, but we're gonna figure it out. If I had a parent that was protecting me instead of shaming me, I would not have the inner critic that I do. And it wasn't until I did, you know, so much work in therapy that I was able to really connect with this protective part of me who just wants to keep me perfect and safe, and really be able to tame that critic. And so for me, that is the most transformative part. And that's the part where I tread very lightly with my clients, because obviously I'm a coach, but not a therapist. But even as a coach, I can point out that the sky is blue, and I can point out that the grass is green, and I can encourage you, like, hey, if the sky is blue and the grass is green, you might want to go talk to a therapist about this and really have, like, engage in a therapeutic relationship. But that inner critic, I would say, is like the one aspect that I no longer attribute to ADHD, but I attribute to trauma.
It's so interesting when I think about it. It's kind of like, it's similar to like with alcoholism, like in a way, like it's as far as like, you know, you get a diagnosis or you've kind of figured out what's wrong with you and you're kind of treating that, you know, but then it's like, are you really getting to the core? You know, it's like, you're kind of treating symptoms.
Yes.
Cause it's almost like, it's like how I now view my alcoholism as a symptom of my complex trauma. And it's like, is your ADHD like a, and how far can one really go? And I'm also curious too, because like with me, and what I think is so common for people in addiction recovery is like hitting this subsequent like bottom, you know? And I'm curious if like similar stuff like that happens with people too, like in their ADHD journey, as far as like at a certain point, do they like hit a wall, you know?
I don't have a personal story or example of that, but I have heard from clients, many clients who have said, like, there's this initial high of, I have a diagnosis, I have an answer, I have a solution, I have a step-by-step process, yay. And they follow all the steps and everything is great for a while as they're like tweaking things and treating their ADHD. And I think for those clients who are highly traumatized, that can only take you so far.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. We're treating the symptoms, but like, even if you learn how to emotionally regulate, you don't understand emotional flashbacks unless you are connected to your trauma. And so for those clients who are highly traumatized, there's a difference between emotional regulation and learning how to name and soothe and process your emotions. And then on the other end of the spectrum, having an actual emotional flashback to when you're 8 years old and you're completely abandoned, except you're 43 and you're standing in your kitchen and you're like, I'm totally safe. And that is not an emotional regulation conversation. That's an emotional flashback conversation. So I do think that for those ADHDers who are highly traumatized, many of them don't know it yet, right? Which is part of my work, is just naming what trauma is. And when we have conversations, sometimes the conversation is pretty short, because what I will say is like, honey, I don't have any coaching for you. It sounds like you're in a trauma response right now. So I just want to like give you a hug and self, like help you to regulate and self-soothe. And what support can you set up for yourself, right? How can I help you to find a therapist who can work through that with you? Because an emotional flashback is so intense. And for those of us with complex PTSD, we're going to have those frequently.
This is probably, there's probably not an answer to this, but I'm curious if you've noticed symptoms manifesting in a different way for those who have more trauma.
I would say they're heightened. Everything is heightened and the critic is heightened and there's so much more shame. So maybe the symptoms are not as like more pronounced necessarily. So ADHD is obviously a spectrum disorder. Some of us are more highly symptomatic in areas than others, but the shame connected to the symptoms for those who are highly traumatized is just off
level,
the charts, off the charts, off the charts. We talk about shame constantly in my program because it's actually the shame that's more debilitating than the symptoms. Like, symptoms are annoying. I will be the first to raise my hand and be like, ADHD is annoying and it works against me in a lot of areas of my life. But when I was also experiencing massive amounts of shame, that's what was debilitating, because I could not persist within the symptom because the shame was keeping me paralyzed. The shame is what brought me into a spiral. The shame is what made it. So I was like, I don't deserve to try. Nobody's going to listen to me. I'm the worst. Therefore, I cannot take steps forward. I cannot persist because the shame is like this
so ball
and chain. Yep. It's debilitating. And so when I have a client who is symptomatic of ADHD, of course, no problem. We're going to work through that. But when they are bound by shame, that's a different conversation. Then we have to have deeper conversations and unpick and unravel. And that takes longer. And that's, of course it does. Of course it does.
Okay. So one thing that I wanted to talk with you about that's very relevant for me, and I've seen that you've just done a couple episodes on like self-trust. One thing, and I guess this is kind of related, but I'm curious what your experience is with this personally and your experience with working with other people is, you know, something that I struggle with is like when we, are like setting ourselves up for failure in the sense of like, before we even start doing something, we just know it's going to be so hard and that we're not going to get anywhere, and just like setting yourself up like for failure when you're expecting to fail before you even start doing something. And it's not even necessarily like reality, you know?
Yeah.
But what is your experience with that, or in helping others, you know, tackle that?
It's such a broad conversation because
I guess it does kind of play into like the self-trust too aspect of it.
I think so. And, you know, we've, as ADHDers, we've collected volumes of evidence that we can't trust ourselves. We've just, like, we can point to 700 examples of, like, I said I was going to do this and then I didn't follow through. And I made this commitment to myself and I didn't follow through. And I mean, over and over and over and over. So how do you help someone who has evidence that they can't trust themselves? How do you help them to shift into someone who can trust themselves? I think the first part to recognize is that self-trust is a developmental process, that if you're not someone who trusts yourself, that's not your fault. That was a developmental process that should have taken place, but didn't. If your needs are seen and validated and met in childhood, if you are taken through this process of just this normal process of being seen, heard, validated, you begin to develop self-trust. That is a normal, natural developmental milestone. What I really want people to understand off the bat is that if you don't have self-trust, it's not because of all of the evidence that you've collected that you can't trust yourself. It's because that developmental milestone was never completed in your childhood. And that's so important to know. And that also really hurts. And nobody wants to hear that, because nobody wants to blame anybody for anything. So we just want to blame ourselves instead of placing blame. And I mean, healthy blame, accountability.
I think it's kind of relieving for me personally.
I mean, same, but you would be shocked at the resistance that I get. Yes. Because it hurts. It's just so painful to acknowledge that that need was not met. So self-trust is built when someone says, I have this need, and the parent says, yes, you do have that need. Let's go meet that need for you. Let me take care of that need for you. Or here's how you can meet that for yourself. Self-trust is depleted or never developed when a child says, I have this need, and the parent says, no, you don't. Come on. This is ridiculous. Why are you so dramatic? What are you complaining about? Don't stop crying or I'll give you something to cry about. Life's tough, kid. It gets worse, okay? Like, I don't know what you're complaining. And then you start to think, oh, okay, I guess I don't know what's right. I don't know what's wrong. I don't know what I need. Okay, so if that's the foundation, then of course, we're going to have all this evidence that we can't trust ourselves. So the first thing that I always want to do is define self-trust. Self-trust is not, I know I'm going to make the right decision all the time. That's what my clients think it is. Like, help me to trust myself. I want to believe that I'm going to make the right decisions all the time. I want to believe that this is going to work out. I want to, like, no, that's not what self-trust is. Self-trust is, no matter what happens, I know I can take care of it. No matter what happens, I know I'm going to get through it. No matter what happens, I'm going to figure this out. That's what self-trust is. No matter what happens, I'm going to believe myself. I believe me. I trust that this need is valid. I trust that this is my desire and it matters. I believe me. And so I think that those two things, first of all, defining what self-trust is and making sure that it's not like, because people say, like, well, this decision didn't work out, so I can't trust myself. It's like, no, all humans go through experiences where the decision does not work out. But that doesn't mean you can't trust yourself. Did you take care of yourself through that?
Yeah.
Have you persisted through that? I think that shining the light on how much evidence you have that you really can trust yourself, that's so important. You've gotten yourself here. Like, you're listening to this podcast, the Adult Child Podcast, on, like, how to heal from all of the stuff that happened to you. You can trust yourself. Look at you taking care of yourself.
Yeah. And how much of it is self-trust is, it's teaching ourselves that we're not going to abandon ourselves. Mm-hmm. I guess largely what it's rooted in.
And for those of us who grew up in families where you had no choice but to self-abandon in order to stay connected and safe, that that reconnection to self is such a long, arduous, but important process. And part of that process is, hey, I got you. I'm not going to let you fall. Even if it doesn't work out, I'm going to take care of us. I'm going to figure it out. That is what self-trust is. It's the connection to self and the commitment to having your own back no matter what. Mm.
So can we talk about building self-trust as it relates to task management, procrastination, time efficiency? How do we start building that trust?
What's hard about that is that those are areas that we suck at.
Yeah.
And so for me and what I teach my clients is in those areas that we know we suck, self-trust isn't, oh my gosh, I'm going to do an amazing job and I'm going to get this right. And I trust myself to make a list and cross everything off and get it right. No. Here's what self-trust looks like. It looks like, I know that this is something that I'm going to procrastinate on. So I'm going to do everything I can to mitigate that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make a plan. I'm going to break everything down into bite-sized steps. I'm going to set up reward systems for myself because my dopamine reward system is broke. And so I need to make sure that I have like little rewards along the way. I'm going to ask for help. Hear me, I'm going to say it again. I'm going to ask for help, okay? Because I trust that I'm going to set myself up to get this done. And I know that this is a weak area for me, so I'm going to ask for help. So self-trust, let's just say in like time management, I know that I will never remember anything unless it's on my calendar. So self-trust for me looks like pause, I'm going to put it on my calendar. Not, oh, I trust myself to remember it, but I know I will forget it. So I'm going to take the time to put it on my calendar and set a reminder. That's what self-trust looks like. So it's this paradigm shift of like, it's not that I trust myself that everything, I'm going to do everything perfectly. It's, I know these are areas that I struggle with. I deserve help. I trust myself to take the necessary steps to make sure I'm supporting myself enough. When an ADHD person is supported, they succeed. If you are not succeeding, it's because you don't have enough support. So what support do we need to add in for you? Can you trust yourself to validate your need for support and follow through on getting it for you?
Can you walk me through, if it can be recent or it could be something that was like the most significant, like what was something that you procrastinated on for like, I mean, I would love to even hear something that like, I just did something that I had been procrastinating on for like over a year, folks. Let's talk about this. I just did it. I'm very proud of myself. It's like, what the fuck? I just needed to input in my episodes, and great, I still need to do it for a chunk, but I did it for like the first half. I needed to put in my episodes in the very beginning before I even started my Patreon. I needed to like put something in there like, hey, since this has been recorded, I started a community. Like, this is where you can find it. So I did that. And then now I just need to add another one that's for once I started the Patreon to be like, hey, since I started the Patreon, I'm now on this thing. But it's like, it literally takes 5 minutes. It's been on my fucking to-do list for a year and a half. Like it's baffling, but compassion, self-compassion, not beating myself up, but I would love to hear about something that was like, something that was like a real struggle for you and how you tackled it.
I will for sure share, but first it's not baffling.
No, I know.
It makes sense.
It is and it isn't.
It's like, it's not really necessary. Your podcast is thriving without it. It's not, there's no one's dying because it's not on there.
Oh, but it's a way that, it's something simple that could, you know, result in me becoming more financially independent. So,
But it also makes sense. Like when we procrastinate, it makes sense. And so
I understand why I do
exactly.
It,
you know? That's the thing. So
but there's
not,
the baffling part of it too. There is, you know, it's both. It's like the rational part of the, I understand like why, you know, but at the same time, it is kind of baffling.
It can be frustrating.
Yes. Frustrating is probably the better word.
I think it's frustrating.
It is.
And when we're frustrated, we're fighting against reality.
Very
like
much.
The reality of like, why is this so hard? This shouldn't be so hard. I should just be able to do this. And it's like, I just always want to come at that with like, no, this is like the hardest thing ever. The simple, easy, mundane, dumb, nobody's dying tasks. Those are so hard.
Yeah. It has deep roots, you know, like anything related to like money generation, becoming more financial. It's not it seems like a simple task, but it has deep roots. So I understand why I do it, but
yes, it's so good. Okay. So a recent example of this for me is my license was expired for like a year and a half.
Driver's license?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I just kind of went through that too. Okay. I mean, wasn't expired, but my car registration, I just did it. And I finally just went and got my Florida driver's license, and I'd been here for a while. So I just did this too, but go ahead. Love hearing this shit.
It was to the point where I had to use my passport to
get in the car. Do you freak out when you're in the car?
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Me too.
And you can't buy alcohol. And at the time, you know, like I'm 6 months sober-ish now, but at the time I was drinking quite a bit. And so I was using my passport to purchase alcohol because my license was expired. I finally got myself to the DMV and timed it because I knew I'm finally here. I've been putting it off forever. How long is this going to take? I wonder how long it's going to take. 7 minutes.
Yeah.
7 minutes. It took 7 minutes to get it renewed and like it was fine. And I just was like, gosh, all of that drama, all of that like mental load, emotional load of procrastination.
The negative excitement.
And it took 7 minutes. And I have a lot of things like that. I'm not as symptomatic in that way anymore. And I ask my husband for a ton of help. So the things like making a return or like things that I would really procrastinate on, I am now at the point where I'm just like, bills. Oh my gosh. I went into collection for like a stupid bill that I just like forgot about, missed. Mm-hmm. So now those things, I'm just like, honey, I like, this is not going to be the thing that I do. And so I just ask him and like, gosh, I have a supportive partner. Most people don't. Most people don't have a supportive partner. Most people's partners shame them, blame them, judge them. And it makes me angry. But I do have a supportive partner who I can ask for help from. And I appreciate it so much because now, and going back to self-trust, I get one of those little bills in the mail and I'm like, I know I'm not going to care about this $7 bill that now I have to mail a check in for $8 or whatever. So I can give it to my husband and say like, I'm never going to pay this. Can you please pay this? And he'll be like, sure. He doesn't care. Oh. I know. I'm so lucky.
What about can you talk about what, if there's any new research or what you're seeing, what you hear in your community as it relates to like what I struggle with so much as far as like phone stuff?
Oh my goodness, I don't know that there is any new research out on the phone stuff, but I will say that this is a persistent struggle for many people with ADHD or addictive tendencies. Obviously, you know more on the addictive tendencies stuff, but for me and my community, they use all kinds of apps to block them out of certain, certain other apps, which is ironic, like use an app to block yourself from an app. Time limits. I'm dealing with a kiddo right now, my own child, who I think has a pretty intense phone addiction. And it's really interesting. So now we are, we have screen time limits and we always have, but he's kind of figured a way to like bypass them. And we caught him on camera, like sneaking down in the middle of the night to be on his phone. Like we always have had them plug in their phones in the kitchen, but So now he plugs it in our bedroom, and also his Xbox controller comes in our bedroom at night, like things like that. It's just so hard because, again, we have to remember that our dopamine reward system is broken. And so we do not get the correct amount of dopamine for just like the mundane, annoying, regular tasks of life. And so we crave it. And that can look like, you know, getting it through alcohol, through drugs, through phone, through food, through porn, whatever the case may be. But your body is designed to have it, and you're gonna go looking for it. And so understanding that that is a big part of what's happening. So for my kiddo, what we're thinking through is, first of all, does his ADHD medication maybe need to be bumped up? He's hit a growth spurt. It hasn't been increased in a year. He's probably gained 25 pounds since then. Like, he's really grown a ton. So that might be a factor. And then also, like, setting him up with other fun things to do. Like, are there other interesting things in your life? Like, is he involved in enough sports? Are we encouraging him to like reach out to friends? Hey, have your friends over. We'll get pizza. Like, are we making it really easy for him to have fun in real life? Because listen, if your real life isn't that fun, you're going to be on your phone a ton, right? Like, set up your life to be more fun. And then, yeah, like having those limits. And sometimes it feels really infantilizing as an adult to put limits on or like use the apps. And I'll hear my clients say, like, I shouldn't have to do this. And y'all, I shouldn't have to. This shouldn't be that hard. It's like, yeah, it should. It should be exactly this hard. This is really, really hard. You should have to do this. And so how can you be the most supportive to yourself in it?
So there's this one app, like people probably, it's called Freedom, but so this is like what I've had to do. So like, you can block apps on there. You can set it up though to like, so that you can't undo it. But the problem is that you could then go on the website and then undo it on your website. So what I had to do was have a friend change the password to the website so that I don't know that. So then I can't get on there then.
Gosh, how does that feel for you? Does that feel like hard, or does that feel like you're being supportive, or what does that feel like?
Yeah, no, it's fine. The problem is that like sometimes the app doesn't work. That's like the only problem. It's
the Freedom
like,
app.
There's like, I don't know what it is or what causes it, you know, but there's been, and usually it does, but like, it was a couple of weeks ago where like I had it set to like block at a certain time, and for some reason it didn't. And then my whole day was fucked, you know?
Yep. Yep. And I feel like I'm talking to my son in his 20s, right? Like, I feel like that is probably how he's going to be, is like, he's such a smart person, and he has a million friends. Like, he's the most social person, but I think he gets sucked in a way that even he doesn't want. And
isn't it like everybody his age? Like, that's what I'm kind of curious. I mean, is this not like,
no,
it's got to be pretty common, right?
I mean, I'm sure it is common, but as a mom who has mom friends, I don't see it as much in other kids. It's just hard to be like the one.
Do you think that that's accurate? Do you think that's accurate though?
I don't know. I mean, what it seems like to me is that other kids are able to be on their screen and then put it down and do something else. And I have created children. The children that have come out of my body will not put down their screens unless I tell them to, or it like a limit comes up. I will say that my oldest now is more self-regulated in this area, and that is beautiful. And it gives me hope for the future. It gives me a lot of hope. So he's 16, and so yeah, there's some more brain development there. And, I think that he is more regulated, but it's really hard to feel like, of course it's my kids that blah, 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 you know, but that's just my own mom issues. So that's okay. I'll deal with that.
Are they allowed to bring their phones to school? Like, what's the deal there?
Well, I have a 16, 14, 10. The 10-year-old doesn't have a phone. So we gave them a phone at 12 with no social media. And then they got Instagram at 13, Snapchat at 14. Like, we tried to just like delay it as much as possible. So what was the question? Do they bring their phones to school? Yes. Yeah.
Are the schools pretty strict about like making
the middle school just finally implemented no phones in the classroom? Finally. So that's wonderful. The high school, it's a pretty much a free for all. They just do whatever. Mm-hmm. It depends on the teacher. Like some teachers are like phones away. Some teachers allow phones.
Can you talk about the connection between like what are the struggles related to parenting and ADHD?
Yeah, I mean, I can talk about it a lot. I would say that the number one issue that I see is emotional regulation. Emotional regulation as a parent with ADHD who's likely parenting neurodivergent children, right? Because ADHD is so inheritable. It's as heritable as height, which is wild to think about. So if you are a parent with ADHD, you are likely parenting a kid or two or three with ADHD. And so emotional regulation is just this skill that most of us did not grow up with. Even people who are not, you know, ADHD, most of us didn't grow up with the skill of emotional regulation. But then because of ADHD, emotions are just heightened. They're more impulsive. Mm-hmm. Our amygdala is so often hijacked. And controlling your own emotions and your own triggers while you're parenting the people who are triggering you the most is just a whole thing. So when I am coaching parents, it is usually on the topic of emotional regulation. And even if we're talking about time management, it is actually usually an underlying emotional regulation issue, which is really interesting.
Explain.
Let's say I have a parent that comes to me and they're like, you know, everything is chaotic. I can't manage my time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Usually the chaos in the background is an unregulated nervous system. Usually the chaos in the background is, kids acting out, needing that, co-regulation and an ADHD parent who has not done the work is not going to be able to co-regulate and help their kiddo to calm down. And so then it just escalates. And all of a sudden I'm screaming at you to get your cleats on because we're late for the soccer game. And the kid is screaming back. And it's just like, that's not actually a time management issue. That's an emotional regulation issue. And if we could just like all calm down, and if I could meet my child where they are, I remember, oh, I have so many memories of shame as I look back on how I parented for my kids' first 10 years of life. And when I have those flashbacks and those memories, I am just overcome with shame, but also gratitude for the repair that I am continuing to make with my kids. But I remembering my middle guy, who was just like mild mannered, the sweetest little guy. And he's crying because he can't get his cleat on. And I remember screaming at him, "Are you actually crying over a cleat?" And like, gosh, that's so mean. And gosh, that's not what my little, he was probably eight. That's not what he needed. The poor sweetheart. So those time management issues are usually connected to our ability to just be cool, stay regulated, not be so chaotic, not be like we're on the spin cycle of the washing machine all the time, and just remain calm as we're getting out the door, as we're doing the things.
Are there any things in particular to keep in mind as it relates to regulating your nervous system that are unique for those that are like neurodivergent?
I think the most important thing that comes to my mind is just understanding how impulsive your emotions are going to be. So while a neurotypical person may not have an emotional reaction to their food coming out wrong at the restaurant, your emotion may be really intense and it's going to be pretty impulsive. It's not going to be something that you're going to be able to control. Like, it's just there. Mm. And so understanding that that does not make you a bad person. It just means that because you have ADHD, you are impulsive and so are your emotions. And so as you learn to validate and regulate the emotions that come up, a big part of that is just accepting how impulsive they are. And just because the emotion is there doesn't mean that it needs to be acted upon. Like, okay, I'm feeling a big feeling. So now I will say, like, wow, I am really feeling a big feeling about this, but I just need a minute to go like calm myself down because I don't think that this is, I don't think it matches the situation. A lot of times my emotions are going to be outsized pertaining to the situation. And that's just a part of having ADHD. That's not because of anything in me. And then also remembering how much trauma I have and how broken my nervous system is and how it's healing, but how, you know, it just was never developed properly. I think that self-acceptance as well. So especially if you come from a highly traumatized environment or like a really toxic environment, I mean, being able to recognize that that's really going to play a big part in your emotions. Mm. And I had to learn, I mean, I just didn't know the basics that like my kids aren't causing my emotions. I thought they were. My kids aren't, their job is not to regulate my emotions. I grew up regulating my parents' emotions. Of course, I parented my kids as if they should be regulating my emotions. And so, yeah. I mean, gosh.
That's how it works?
It's so wild to think that that is how I thought it worked because kids are the worst when it comes to regulating emotions. Like, they're so bad at it. And it's just wild to think that I actually did develop the skill of regulating my parents' emotions and was not so bad at it at all. And when you think about the survival skills that you develop as a kiddo, sometimes it's wild to think about.
How is your parenting in the way in which you've shown up for your kids changed just in the last year or so that you've been coming to terms with all the stuff with your parents?
I mean, it's significantly different. And it's been 3.5 years that I've been doing this work on my parents. So in that amount of time, I would say the most significant shift is just validating their experience, not invalidating. The most significant shift is in validating their experience and believing them.
Mm.
I believe my kids. When they tell me anything, I believe them, except like, how much time did you spend on the Xbox today? I don't believe anything they say when it comes to that. But when they are having an experience, I believe them. When they are upset, I believe them. When they are stressed out, I believe them. And that's a gift that I've given to myself. I now believe myself, and I will forever believe my kids from now until the day that I die. I believe you. If that's how it happened, I believe you. And that is just made a significant change in our relationship. I remember right around the time that I started doing, I was being coached, but I wasn't in therapy yet. So maybe 2017, 2018, I remember writing in a journal, I don't feel connected to my kids. My goal this year is to feel connected to your kid, to my kids. Imagine being a mom of three and not feeling connected to your children. Mm-hmm. I didn't know at the time that connecting to my kids would cause me to lose everything in my family of origin because I could not connect to my kids and stay connected to my parents. It was impossible. So I chose the relationship with my children over the relationship with my parents. And I
explain
would do that. It again.
Explain how you couldn't do both. And how did you come to terms with that?
In order to connect to my kids, I had to start believing them. In order to start believing them, I had to start believing myself.
Yeah.
In order to believe myself, I had to acknowledge the reality of the neglect and abuse and isolation and gaslighting that I was subjected to. And I also had to acknowledge that, like, yes, that happened a long time ago, but also the relationship that we have now is not a relationship that I can tolerate. And I had to just believe myself over and over and over. And there was no way for me to stay connected to myself and to my parents. I tried for 3.5 years. I tried to tweak it. I tried to therapize it. I tried to ask for it. I tried everything. But there was just no way to stay connected to myself and to my parents. The only way that I can connect to my kids is if I'm connected to myself. Mm-hmm. So it was like this triangle of like people pulling at me and making a conscious decision of, okay, I can no longer say, well, that's just your Grammy. That's just your pop. That's just how they are. I had to believe my kids about their experience of my parents. I had to believe my kids about their experience of life. And that meant that I could no longer deny my own experience. So I think that that's really deep. And if you haven't been through that process, it might not connect to you, but because of the severity of what I had experienced, I just could not stay connected to myself and my kids and my parents at the same time.
How have you navigated conversations with them as far as the boundaries that you've set with their grandparents? And how has that looked different based off what age they are? Like, is it because you can, you know, it depends on how old they are and what they can comprehend. And I'm curious if it looks different based off of how old they are.
It's really interesting. I would say the boundaries themselves don't look different based off of how old they are, but the conversations and the depth of conversation does look different. And also, I want to meet my kids with as much vulnerability as they feel comfortable with. So one of the key factors in my family of origin, my relationship with my parents, was forced vulnerability. And that might-
What does that look like?
Ugh. It's a question I don't want to answer. It just looked like forced vulnerability. It looked like sharing things that I didn't want to share. It looked like revealing things that I didn't want to reveal and then being punished for what I revealed. It looked like a lot of exploitation of vulnerabilities. And one of the things that I'm committed to is never forcing vulnerability with my kids, but always meeting them with or matching what they are comfortable with. And so each kiddo has a different tolerance level for conversation around their grandparents, for an understanding, for hearing my story. One of them, I really want to make sure to be careful to protect their anonymity. But one of them wants to hear everything. He's like a little therapist. How did that make you feel, mommy? That must have been so hard for you, mommy. Tell me everything. I want to know more. He wants to know everything. And so I have to be really careful not to emotionally parentify him and to not share too much and to just say, like, it is hard, but I'm also being supported and I don't need you to support me, just so you know. Like, I will make sure to tell you age appropriate stuff, but I don't need your support. Another kiddo, we had maybe two or three conversations and he grieved a little bit and then moved right along. Mm-hmm. Another kiddo is having like a harder experience. And honestly, when I was going through the process and wanting to talk to the kids about it and kind of explain it, he was not on board with hearing any of it. And so at the time, which was like a year and a half ago, when we were making these decisions and I was like trying to share it with the kids, this child didn't want to talk about it. And so he would just like try to excuse himself for the conversation. I don't want to hear this. And we just let him, okay, you don't have to talk about it. Like, that's fine. So now this summer, he's circling back around and starting to ask those questions. And he's starting the grieving process that the other two went through a year and a half ago, which is a really interesting thing to navigate because he wasn't ready at the time to confront any of it or to feel any of those feelings. Now he's ready and I just want to be done with it, but I have to like be there and really hold space for that. So those are ongoing conversations that we're having with him.
That's really interesting. It's so, and I know that your parent, your sisters have set similar boundaries. It's interesting. Like, are there any grandchildren that are like wanting to like still have a relationship with their grandparents, and how has that been navigated?
Yes, there are. And as their parents, we're pretty united on, if your grandparent can't have a healthy relationship with me, then there's no way that they're going to have a relationship with you. So the relationship that a grandparent has with their grandchild goes through the parent. And if you can have a healthy relationship with the parent, then you get access to the kids. Great. And that's what we all long for, all of us. That's what we would all want, is healthy relationships. But if you're not able to have a healthy relationship with the child, then you do not have the opportunity to have relationship with the grandchildren. And that has been particularly hard for one of the grandkiddos. And they are wanting to reach out. And that is so hard to navigate because, you know, they might be mad at us for the rest of their lives for that. And that's just something that we're willing to own. And we'll say to them, hey, you have the right to be angry about this and you might be mad for the rest of your life. And I can handle that. What I can't handle is exposing you to toxicity and abuse that I can't protect you from. That's what I can't handle. I can handle your anger. I'm here for your anger. Be angry. I can handle it. What I can't handle is exposing you to abuse and not being able to protect you from that.
I've had a couple episodes. I guess I've had two episodes with siblings. One was like three sisters, and then one was, yeah, two sisters, two brothers. And just how varying everyone's experiences are. Like, you and your sisters are very united on this front. How much does your perception of what you guys experience differ as far as kids?
Such a great question. I think I talked to you about this when we chatted on my podcast, Patrick Tien's Toxic Family.
Oh yeah. I still need to look at that. Yeah.
Okay. So Patrick Tien, who I adore, he's a therapist and he has this toxic family test, which I think is really useful for anyone. If you're curious about like, how bad was it really in my family?
Oh, I think you did. You were telling me this. Yeah. Yeah. You guys had very similar answers.
We all three came back with scores in the 90s. Mm. So it was like off the charts toxicity. And that was really interesting because, we're three siblings. All three of us are neurodivergent. One of my sisters is autistic. All three of us have been diagnosed with ADHD. We are 6.5 years apart, you know, so like me and then 3.5 years and then almost three more years. And we did have quote unquote different parents in that, you know, like my kids also have different parents, right? It's like you're a different person. But the threads are all the same: parentification, isolation, gaslighting, emotional neglect, and a lack of protection. All of those threads are the same. It manifested in different areas. Some of us had it harder than others. Some of us were parentified more severely than others, but those threads run all the way through. And so when we are together, it's beautiful and we're really different people. But to be able to have that common bond. I know it's really rare. It's so rare to have a whole sibling group be on the same page. And I just feel so grateful for it.
When did your sister get diagnosed with autism? Was that like later in life?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Later in life, definitely. So she was diagnosed, I'm trying to remember, I would probably say 2020, maybe 2021. And yeah, it was probably 2021 actually, because I had had somebody, a friend of mine who was ADHD, and then she was diagnosed with autism. I had her on my podcast and she was telling me about the symptoms of autism in women. And I was like, oh,
I need to do an episode about that.
I don't
really know much about it, but there's a couple people in my community that, you know, have had late in life diagnoses that mm-hmm. I'm curious mm-hmm. in learning more about it.
It's a wonderful thing to explore. And so many people are missed, and especially women are rarely diagnosed properly with autism. And let me tell you, it explains everything. It explains so much about who she is, about how she interacts with the world, about how she interacts with me as her sister, about how our relationship was really difficult. It was very difficult. And to be able to see it through the lens of a diagnosis of autism rather than putting the blame on her. Mm. And she was the scapegoat in a lot of ways of the family, which of course makes sense. It's so awful. And it's so like textbook, you know, it's like a predictive script. But she was the scapegoat for a long time. We took turns in that role, as you do in narcissistic family systems, but she was a scapegoat quite a bit. And so instead of her being the problem, we get to look at a diagnosis and plus trauma, and we get to say, oh, so much of this is explained. So much of this makes sense. And there's so much more compassion and empathy and love and care and connection because of that diagnosis.
Hmm.
Yeah.
If you have any recommendations of people to talk to, I'm totally open to it. So,
yeah, that would be great.
You can get back to me. All right. So what do you want to promote? What are you working on? What do you want to talk mm-hmm. about? What do you want to push, sell, whatever? You tell me, Liddy. What are you jazzed about? Anything?
That's a great question. I only sell one thing, and that is my ADHD coaching program. I am always jazzed about it. We have just the most wonderful supportive community, and healing happens in community. And so if you are an ADHDer and you are desperate for community, we got you. It's called Focused. You can go to my website, ihaveadhd.com, but it's not accessible to everyone. And I would just recommend starting with the podcast. I think to have a body of work like the podcast, it's been around since early 2019. I think there's just so much value there. And I've interviewed all of the experts that, you know, of the ADHD books that are sitting on your shelf collecting dust. And to be able to hear their voices, Russell Barkley, Ned Halliwell, Patricia Quinn, Sari Solden, all those people that have written the books that we read, they're just amazing. And to be able to have that body of work, I just highly recommend that. Like, go do the free thing before you do anything.
I would think that, like, now with this, like, you coming to terms with the trauma stuff too, it's like that opens up like so many more topics mm-hmm. and that probably just like makes things a lot more interesting for you too, right?
It does. What I always worry about, and this is just like friend to friend, pretending mm-hmm. no one else is listening.
You don't want it to get like watered down?
Well, I don't want it to get too deep or too above the heads of people who are just beginning the journey. Do you know what I mean? Like, would I have been able to handle a conversation about trauma 6 years ago? I don't know. And so I do worry, like, I really try to have a balance of like really basic fundamental information and then the deeper work. But in the program, in the Focus coaching program, that's where we do a ton of deep work, especially the longer that you're in the program. So if you're a VIP or if you're an A-lister, so like 6 months or a year in, we're doing all kinds of like complex PTSD and trauma mm-hmm. work. Yeah, that part's super fun. So I kind of get it out of my system in that area.
That way, yeah.
Yeah, and I try to keep the podcast pretty fundamental just so that people who are just learning about ADHD are really able to connect with it.
Yeah, I don't know if you've come across her before, but I recently had her on my podcast and she has a book on ADHD. Her name is Dr. Amelia Kelly. You should connect with her. I think you would really like her.
What is her book?
I think she's something that has 88 powers in the title. But I was a big fan.
I love that you were a big fan and you don't remember the title of her book.
She has other books that we talked about.
Validating to me. That's awesome.
Powered by ADHD, strategies and exercises for women to harness their.
Oh, yes.
Untapped gifts.
Yep. That's a new book, right?
I don't know. I think so. Let's see. When did it come out? It's new.
Yeah. This year, right?
Yeah. A couple months ago.
Yesterday. It came out yesterday. Yeah. That's cool. Yes. When you read the subtitle, I knew I had heard about that. That's cool. Yeah. I'll connect with her.
Yeah. I dug her. Well, thank you so much. I'll put all your shit in the show notes.
I just really like you and I'm
thank
so
you. I love chatting with you
to connect and I love the work that you're doing. So just thanks for having me. Don't let it all go.